You never know what kind of music we're going to use. I kind of like this one. We've been using it for a while. Maybe we'll switch one of these days. Anyway, it's time for Spectrum West. When you hear the music, that's what we're about. This is one of the bigger weekends of the year in the city of Eau Claire. It's Jazz Festival. Since 1967, the Eau Claire Jazz Fest has been growing, putting Eau Claire as a bigger spot on the musical map. Today, we'll be talking with Darman Meter. He's one of the fourth, or he's actually one-fourth, of the singing sensation New York Voices. They are the Friday night headliners. Bruce Taylor is back to add to the spectrum because it's National Poetry Month, a time when poets celebrate their craft by sharing it even more enthusiastically than they normally do. Bruce talks poetry and will share a couple of originals with us. I'm Al Ross, and this week we get a double scoop of Jim Oliver. As Jim has coaxed a couple people busy directing theater productions to take a few minutes to fill us in on what's going on, how it's going, and who's making it happen. A bit later, he talks with Arthur Grothy, directing The Three Sisters at UW Eau Claire's Care Theater. But for the first scoop of Oliver, let's look to one of our westernmost locations, Hudson, Wisconsin, and see what the always active Phipps Center for the Arts is up to theatrically.
The Odd Couple, the female version, runs Fridays through Sundays through April 26th at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Joining us by telephone to talk about Neil Simon's female version of his original play is the director, Casey Jean Tennell. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, I might just point out that Casey's suffering from a bad cold, so this is not her normal voice. The female version of The Odd Couple came along 20 years after the original male version. I read some reviews about the show, and I was just curious. Most of the reviewers seemed to think the play was really funny, but wondered why it actually had been written, because it was so similar to the original show. Aside from the gender, are there differences in the versions?
Well, actually, no, there aren't that many differences. He just changed it to female characters, I believe, because the popularity of the male version. Mm-hmm. So many people had spoken to Mr. Simon and said, I wonder what this would be like as females. And so he decided to write a script and turn things into the female version. Instead of playing poker, they play Trivial Pursuit. Mm-hmm. Instead of Pigeon Sisters, which is in the male version, it's a pair of Spanish brothers, mm-hmm. called the Costazuela brothers. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to hear Mr. Simon speak about 9 or 10 years ago at the Guthrie. And he said the reason he changed it and redid the version in the 80s was because so many people had asked and were thinking of writing their own versions, that he wanted to just do it himself so he could do it the way he would do it and not have somebody else rewrite his vision.
I believe one of your actors posted a YouTube video of a rehearsal, and he said that the female version would have been the most prominent had it come first. Do you agree with that?
Probably, because it's pretty funny. It's pretty true to life situations.
I noticed in the publisher's notes on the play that they give warnings of various things like alcohol, strong language, mild adult themes, and smoking.
Right.
Are you able to show the character smoking, or do the women smoke?
Yes, one of the characters does smoke. It's not an actual cigarette that we use. We're playing with the e-cig version, which we are able to use on stage. And if that doesn't work for us, then we have backup magic cigarettes that just look like they're lit. You're not really smoking on stage.
Mm-hmm. Many, many, many years ago, more years than I care to think about, I was in a production of The Odd Couple. That was back in the days when you could smoke anywhere. The director said we were supposed to puff up as much smoke as we possibly could so that when the curtain opened, the smoke would waft out over the audience. And it was quite effective, I guess.
Right.
But as a non-smoker, it was not terribly effective for me, but that was another story. Who are the actors in the show?
Our leads are Anne Spradley, and I believe she's from Oakdale, Minnesota. She plays Olive. Mariah Christensen, who comes from St. Paul by way of Blue Earth, Minnesota, is Florence Unger. And then our supporting cast of females are Stacey Medlin is playing Sylvie. She is from Woodbury. Linnea Sudman, also from, I believe, the Woodbury, Minneapolis area, is playing Renee. Abigail Heimel, who hails from Roberts, Wisconsin, is playing Vera. And Trisha Cook, from Woodbury is playing Mickey the Cop. And then two Hudson gentlemen are playing the Costanzuela brothers. Dan Bushman, he is Manolo, the older of the brothers. Eric Olson is playing his brother, Jesus.
She is Casey Jean Tennell, who is director of The Odd Couple, the female version, at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. I always like to talk about things like set design and all of that stuff. And what kind of set do you have for this show?
Our set is wonderfully designed by Sadie Ward. I think this is her second time at the Phipps. She has designed an apartment, an upper-scale apartment, supposed to be Riverside Drive in New York, that Olive lives in. At the onset, we'll see it as messy as can be because Olive, as people know, takes after the Oscar character, and she is just a mess. She says that she's been sloppy since she was a kid and even had Diet Coke on her wedding dress when she got married. And then we'll transform into a much cleaner version once Florence comes in and moves in around about the second scene to this beautiful Riverside Drive apartment in Manhattan.
As I recall, the props people were pretty busy during the show. Is that
they are.
How do they go about finding junk to throw on a stage?
It's a combination of the Phipps prop room and people's basements. Some of it's come from my car. just people bringing in things that they might have in and around their houses. Sarah and Kim are props designers. Not only do they have to provide all of the stuff for one set of living, but they also have to double some of the stuff because of the two different living styles that are taking place in the show. There's also an amazing amount of food in the show, which our running crew will expertly have to prepare for each night to eat and things like that. I don't even know what I want to think about to count how many props we use in the show, but it's it's a big, good number.
That's why you have props people. You're the director. You're the boss.
Exactly. I just tell them what I want, and and they come up with two Trivial Pursuit boards and things like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think it's been 3 years or 4 years, perhaps, since we last spoke. You directed Dixie Swim Club, as I remember.
Correct.
Talk about your other experience in directing.
I love directing. It's an opportunity for me to delve into the lives of other people, probably more interesting people than I am myself. I kind of liken it to playing with live dolls on stage because you get to tell the actors where to move and why they should be playing the scene the way they are and things like that. You get to dress them up, tell them what to eat, tell them what to hold in their hands. I really like to tell stories about friendship, making real characters out of those that we see on the page. And friendship is my specialty, I think, because it's a part of everybody's life. My belief is that the cast, if they can become friends outside of the script pages, then that will help them have a better base as they get on stage to present the story, that they can actually become those people, listen to each other, because that they're supported by each other as friends. And I think that this group really does just that. They all like each other. They have each other's backs, and they're there through thick and thin to tell the story with what we've been given by Mr. Simon.
What are some of your favorite plays that you've directed?
My favorite play actually would be the Dixie Swim Club, closely followed, I think, are some of the children's performances that I've done at the Phipps. It's just so much fun to work with kids because they have such a raw energy that they all have so many ideas. And trying to incorporate all of those ideas into one stage production is oftentimes a chore, but it's a fun chore to do. And I think every show that I've done, I keep a little piece in my heart because you get to be friends with those people for the 12 weeks that you're working on a production. So I like to think that they stay with you sometimes.
The play is The Odd Couple, the female version. The show continues Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays through April 26th at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. For ticket information, you can go online to thephipps.org. We've been talking to the play's director, Casey Jean Tennell. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tim.
Coming up, it's Poetry Month, so we have one of our best to celebrate with us. And the New York Voices are part of the Eau Claire Jazz Festival Friday evening. We're going to hear their marvelous sound and more. You're listening to Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UW Eau Claire's Department of Music and Theater Arts, presenting The Three Sisters, a new translation of a Russian play that deals with the distance between reality and drams, through August 26th at Kara Theater. Tickets at 800-949-UWEC. Here's a Spectrum memo. The exhibit is The Alchemy of the Imaginary, featuring works of artist Christine Alfery, through May 1st in the Janet Carson Gallery at the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center. EauClaireArts.com is that website. Well, it is National Poetry Month, a time for rediscovery. It really is an interesting, rewarding trip to take through a book of verse by a favorite poet. I believe it's found in the Smell the Roses category of things we should do more often. Bruce Taylor has taught English, writing, poetry, and more at UW Eau Claire. He's of the emeritus variety of professor now. He's also a prolific reader of verse to live audiences. And he served as poet laureate for the city of Eau Claire for a bit more than one term, and I believe he may be rolling over into another stint as we speak. Speaking of speaking, we did. Well, I think we ought to talk commemorative months and days for a minute. I guess what people don't realize is that, and this makes sense because of the jazz festival, but it's Jazz Appreciation Month.
Yes, yes.
And you know, the days thing is interesting, too. So for our audience, if you're listening on Thursday the 16th, it is National Eggs Benedict Day. It's National Wear Your Pajamas to Work Day.
Yes.
It's National High Five Day. This would be right up your alley. It's National Support Teen Literature Day.
Yes, and it's also today, which I will announce, it's National Expose Day. I haven't yet finished buying all the cards that I have to for that one.
And if you're listening on Friday the 17th, it's National Bat Appreciation Day. It's National Haiku Poetry Day.
Mm-hmm. It's also, this month is National Walk Around Things Day.
But the reason we're talking to you, as if we need a reason, is that it is National Poetry Month.
And it is indeed.
If I were looking at you, I could see it in your eyes and on your face that you're ready to burst because, as I'm sure all poets are, because it's National Poetry Month.
You know, and I hope you have purchased your greeting cards and
and
got your gifts all bought also. I just remind you that if you're buying gifts for your local poets who are over 65, the traditional gift is cash. I'm just mentioning it.
Good. And had you not reminded me, I must confess that I probably would have let it slip by without commemoration. But I also learned more at poets.org, which is a wonderful, wonderful
website. Sure, that's a major site, the big one, yeah.
I saw on that website that they're inviting students, grades 5 to 12, to write letters to poets. It's called It's called Dear Poet.
Yep.
They're being invited to write after hearing select poems read via video on that website.
Poetry.org, you know, tied in with Poetry Magazine, which is the magazine, you know, the one that Harriet Monroe and Ezra Pound founded in 1912.
Mm.
And a few years ago, this woman, I think, I don't want to get her name wrong, but I think it was Ruth Lilly, she died and donated an incredible amount of money to Poetry Magazine. And she had submitted, I don't know how many times, to Poetry Magazine, and they had never published her. I mean, it was $100,000 at least, if not more.
Hmm.
And so they've been able to do all these cool things since then, you know. And they're all over the place now, and we're glad to have them.
Back to the, we were talking about the students writing the letter. You were once embroiled in the art of mentoring, and I made some observations. Poetry is one of an English class's best friends. It makes friends when English alone may not. Students of mostly any age are challenged in a good way by poetry. It's the fun part of English. Any of that accurate?
Yes, I think a great deal of it is. I think there are other fun parts of English, too, but certainly. And there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, just the nature of poetry, you know, and particularly the play aspect to it. Never mind the individual creative aspect where you get to express yourself. I had taught, you know, all sorts of writing over the years, and I used to teach freshman composition. And then I would teach creative writing also.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I never had anyone plagiarize creative writing. You know, they would always come up with their own original thing, and that was not always true in a freshman composition. And if you give a kid a D in a composition, you know, he may say bad things about you and walk away. But if you give someone a bad mark on a poem, you have wounded them for a long time.
Yeah, oh boy. Now, you and I aren't best of friends, nor have we known each other more than a few years, but I'm going to speculate that you consider your life to this point pretty well-lived, fulfilling.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Over that span, you've earned several labels, probably too numerous to mention.
And some you can't.
That's true. It's his radio, after all. Is the identifier poet, is that your favorite?
Well, if I actually could only choose one, it would be teacher, you know. But somewhere along the line, a number of years ago, I don't even know who did this, but they began to refer to me at the university as poet professor.
Hmm.
That's not an official designation. They kept calling me that. I'm not sure where it came from. And, you know, more than even the designation of poet, that's always a tough, when you're young and you're first starting out, what I hear over and over again, I can't call myself a poet. Mm-hmm. I just can't. Well, of course you can, you know. But when you're young, you feel that that's too something that you'll never achieve.
Sure.
Lofty,
sure.
You know.
Yeah.
But I have certainly been delighted that I've been able to make, you know, a fairly decent living. You know, I'm not starving. Doing something that I absolutely love and sharing something that I absolutely love. Yeah, I'm a pretty lucky guy.
What does writing poetry do for you? What does it add to your life?
It makes me pay attention. It's like all those things that you're supposed to do, you know, on a regular basis, if not daily, that I don't necessarily do. It's like exercise in a way, you know. It's like prayer, you know, in a way.
Mm.
It's like, you know, flipping your mattress every 6 months. You're supposed to do that. Nobody I know actually does that. It really is all those things for me. Robert Bly talks about the importance of a sacred place and a sacred time in a person's life. And he especially talks about that moment where you set aside maybe the same place every day and the same time every day as much as you can for sort of, you know, in his case, it would be meditation and would be reflection and be study. And all those things come for me in poetry. I started off that way for many, many years, and then at the professor part began to take over from the poet. Every day there was a fire I had to put out, you know.
Sure.
So, but since I've retired, I'm back to that, and I'm, you know, at it every day. I sit. It's like waiting for a wave for a surfer, you know. You just sit and you wait, and you see if it, you know, if it's going to happen. Not inspiration.
Ah.
That's for amateurs. But I'm talking about, you know, is that process going to happen that day? And if it does, I can now run with it as long as it may be, an hour, two, sometimes longer. If it doesn't, then I go and, you know, walk the dog and empty the litter box and that kind of stuff.
As you're sitting waiting for that wave, are you thinking of a topic?
No, never a topic. Okay. Never a topic. A phrase, a word, an image, a memory. Sometimes what I do, and I advise many of my students over the years to do this, if you're just there and, you know, nothing seems to be happening, look out the window. Even if it's that window you've looked out for 15 years, 20 years, you know, just look out the window. I think sometimes people begin to write and they look too much into themselves, gaze at their own navel and wonder about me and the universe, you know.
Yeah. Well, it would be wrong for us not to ask you to recite a poem or two, it being National Poetry Month and you being the guy.
Well, okay, I would love to. As a matter of fact, I have a collection that I've been working on, which is pretty much all poems on poetry. So
I'm hoping the recitation comes across as well on the telephone. We should point out that you had planned on being in the studio, but you had a little eye surgery.
I did. I thought I'd be driving today, but they said I should take one day just to keep the highway safe.
We thank you for staying off the streets.
Thank you. Sometimes I feel that's the way I contribute to the world best.
So what do you have?
Okay, this one is particularly apt, I think, and it's called The Test. This is only a test. If this were a real poem, you'd be instructed to turn to the Norton Anthology of Poetry or any old issue of The New Yorker. If this were a real poem, your teacher would have assigned it, would be asking, what does it mean, but you wouldn't know, and not just because you wouldn't have read it. If real poetry conditions were prevailing, I would be speaking right now how last night or a week ago I stepped out my back door, looked out my study window, walked in the park, took the car in for an oil change, went to the grocery store or got laid and felt something, sort of religious. But this is just a test. A proper poem I'd be reading in my best NPR voice and pausing often and much longer than necessary. And at the end of each line, my voice would quaver sincerely just where I planned it to. And at the end of each line, it would always rise. That's how you know it is poetry. If this were a real poem, my father would ignore it. My mother hate it. My sister envy how I got to leave home to write it, and she didn't. My neighbors would snicker. My students yawn some more. The cats sleep. Old lovers fume. My wife sigh. My children cringe. But my dog would understand and forgive. I would not be cursing merely to shock, nor weeping just for effect, or ever use any word the average reader might find tchotchkish, fugacious, or prodromal. A poem of mine would rhyme all the time. The words ring and chime, bump and grind, alliterate to titillate totally, and all the assonance would always be awesome. It would be chock full of similes, like a fat bag of skinny cats, like a pocket full of pockets, like a beautiful woman's beauty or a rich man's luck, like your grandfather's wallet or your grandmother's décolletage, like a fat man's cummerbund, like a rabbit full of hats. In fact, my poem itself would be one intricate analogy, a fox in a forest fire, crap through a goose. Admit it, when you stop to think about it, a lot of life is really more the same as lots of other things, more than you might imagine. Metaphorically speaking, the eye is the horizon, the hand, touch, and tool, first spear, then missile, the span of many steps, the distance we must cross, the ear, sound, and seeker of sound in the silence, which is the voice longing in the darkness to speak. But this right here, this is only a test.
You know, if the poetry thing doesn't work out, you could always be a public radio guy. Those pauses were...
I've learned from the best, you know.
Wonderful stuff. Well, what's next?
This one is called Why I Don't Write Poetry Anymore. The way the sun on the water, actually on the very tips of the small ripples, shines. No, reflects. Maybe glitters. No, of course, the way the sun ripples, that's not it either, for it's just the tips that shine. No, glow. No, that's not right. Did I say I am speaking of the lake outside my window? Have I said it eddies and streams fed by five small springs? But the sun on the water most days and this season for days and days on end, right about this time, obviously, however, only when the sun is out and clouds are few. Gold coins tossed across the surface, each caught by each tiny ripple for the briefest moment, then passed on to the next ripple moment. Are like stars flaring in the sky, if stars shone gold like the sun, and each spark was a twinkling, and if the sky were water, blue and deep, not black and far away. Needless to say, not in winter, when the lake and sky are ice and the sun fierce and frozen low at the end of an endless tunnel, gray on gray, opaque, endless. Have I said these days my love makes the coffee and makes a fire before she leaves for work, so I can sit and see what I have to see?
Wow. You're the guy who graces our microphones every once in a while and graces them gracefully. Those poems were wonderful.
Oh, thank you, sir. And I, you know, always enjoy myself when I'm talking to you.
Bruce Taylor, the poet professor. Actually, the professor part is in the rear view mirror, but the poet keeps writing, and we're glad that he does. You're listening to Spectrum West, and we thank you for doing so. Here's a Spectrum memo. It's a one-man show of strange and often hilarious life-on-the-road stories as told by Steve Russell, who's traveled the globe as an entertainer in various degrees. The Casual Suspect is Sunday evening, 7 p.m., Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Tonight, by the way, Thursday, it's the Big Band Experience featuring Sean Johnson at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Tickets, 832-ARTS, that's the phone number, online at eauclairearts.com.
got to do is sing. Sing, 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 sing. All you got to do is sing. All you got to do is sing. Girls and boys, make a noise. Just try singing with a swing.
Sing, 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 sing. Everybody likes to sing. Summer, fall, winter, spring. These are all good times to sing.
The fabulous sound of the New York Voices. Darman Meter is one of the original members of New York Voices. He's coming to Eau Claire along with Kim Nazarian, Peter Eldridge, and Lauren Kinnan to entertain his Friday headliners at the Big Eau Claire Jazz Festival. We spoke earlier this week with Darman from his home in New Jersey, just across from the Big Apple. Let's for a moment enter the Wayback Machine, going back some 27 years to 1988. Ithaca College, a quintet. How did the original group find each other?
Well, Peter Eldridge and Kim Nazarian, Caprice Fox and I, are all Ithaca grads. Caprice is no longer in the group, but she is, if you go back to that early, the early days, she was a member of the group on our first three recordings back in the late 80s and early 90s. So the four of us were four of the original quintet, and we all were Ithaca College graduates in the early and mid 80s. And in the summer of 1986, we had a chance to be part of an alumni project that was put together by Dave Riley, who was the vocal jazz director at the college. And he put together an alumni project to take over to Europe to some summer festivals that invite a lot of college and U.S. groups to come over and perform. And we participated in that group just as a sort of a fun thing for the summer, but it really triggered the idea of trying to put together something professionally. And shortly after that, Peter and Caprice and Kim and I put together the group that became the professional group New York Voices, along with Sarah Krieger, who was another wonderful singer that we had met in New York. And so that was the quintet, the professional group that came out in 88, started in 88, and started playing little clubs in New York and writing all of our own arrangements and our own repertoire, and just kind of started digging in, and things kind of took off from there.
I'm so glad to talk to you at home, because after reading your bio, I had to take a nap. I mean, you're a busy guy.
Well, especially if you read all four of our bios, it's kind of a hectic schedule that we lead. But it's a fun combination of performing with New York Voices, and also all of us to varying degrees are doing some of our own solo work, and we're all very active in education, teaching at different schools and doing workshops and clinics and guest artist appearances and all kinds of fun stuff. So, it doesn't get boring. We'll leave it at that.
No kidding. Back to your long-standing makeup, a couple of personnel changes. But since 94, you've been the quartet that you are now. I refer to these three terms that I chose from reading various group and individual bios: chameleon-like, complexity, and chemistry. Now, in order to pull off those kinds of feats, being familiar with each other kind of helps a lot, doesn't it?
Definitely. The group has evolved over the years, partly personnel shifts in the early days and also shifting from a five-voice group to a four-voice group. But most of those changes happened in the early days of the group. We settled in, as you mentioned, into the current quartet format in 1994. Lauren Kinnan joined in 1992. The evolution of the repertoire or the style of our repertoire has shifted a little bit over time, but we've always enjoyed doing a variety of styles. So I guess that's the chameleon-like part of the equation. You know, we love the American Songbook, of course, and we wander into some of the more instrumental sides of jazz, pulling from composers like John Coltrane or Oliver Nelson or things like that you think of more as instrumentalists. But we also love some of the repertoire that we grew up listening to as kids, from the pop side of things. Stevie Wonder or James Taylor or Paul Simon or Earth, Wind & Fire, you know, fill in the blanks with all that kind of wonderful stuff. And we like to compose some of our own music. But the common thread is this sort of four-voice, close harmony sensibility. And the style shifts a bit, but there is that sort of connected thread of that four-part sound.
It makes me, when I talk to people like you, think about harmony, because harmony is it's such a wide spectrum of things. Let's talk about harmonies. Are there different genres of harmony? Is there jazz harmony? Is there pop harmony? Is there country harmony? And the other side to that question is, are there templates for the kinds of harmony you can achieve, or is it fun to just make up your own?
It is fun to make up your own, but there are templates, too, that kind of come out of the history of different styles of music. Now, there is various parameters that you associate with different types of music. in pop music as a, you know, an overgeneralization perhaps, but you tend to think of the music being a little bit more triadic and not oftentimes having the 4 and 5 note chords that create some of the bigger tensions that you associate with jazz. And jazz harmony tends to have a lot of these 7s and 9s and all these notes that add all this wonderful color.
Yeah.
It also, what we do is sing what we call four-way close harmony, so that we're not necessarily singing the bass notes. When you think of music like a Bach chorale or Beethoven or something, or an a cappella piece from classical music, your bass singers are singing down at the bottom of the range and singing the roots of the chords, and then it builds from there. What we're doing is we are singing all of the harmony that you might associate with maybe the saxophone section in a big band, mm-hmm. or the way a piano player would voice a piano when he's comping in the jazz style. And we leave the bass and all that walking stuff to the bass player. So we're kind of singing that close harmony. The notes are close together, and so you get a lot of that rubbing and tension that you associate with jazz harmony that you might not hear quite as much if you were listening to more of a classical choir.
Now you madly right or wrong, sounds like the lyric of a song. But since it's so, I thought that you ought to know. I love you madly. Better fish are in the sea, it's not the theory for me. And that's for sure, just like I said before, I love you madly. If you could see the happy you and me I dream about so proudly. You know the breath of spring that makes me sing my love song so loudly. Good things come to those who wait, so just relax and wait for fate. To let me see the day that you'll say to me, I love you madly. Oh, I love you madly. Night and day sounds like the makings of a play. Like Juliet and Romeo, Cleopatra and her crony, overwhelmed with desire, we're playing with fire. You know I love you.
On the phone with Darman Meter, New York Voices. He's 25% of that group. They're appearing Friday evening, 7 o'clock, State Theater, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. State Theater, a vintage venue. That should be a lot of fun. Darman, in thinking about musical groups, especially jazz, which is the theme of the Wisconsin Festival you're attending, I've marveled at the jazz musicians' ability among all of those that I've spoken to over the years. The capacity to sit in with someone and riff or improvise, following leads and soloing sometimes. And I abruptly wondered at that point, hey, can jazz singers do that? I mean, I know you guys can scat and improvise, you know, that way with a band, but can really good jazz vocalists use their instrument or their voice to jam with other singers without any preparation?
Definitely. As a collective group, the four of us can't necessarily just jump in and sing a song as a four-part harmony group. That obviously takes some planning ahead
to
create the arrangement. But as individuals, we do that all the time. Jazz vocalists, in the same way that jazz instrumentalists learn a core repertoire, you know, the American Songbook, jazz standards, and you know, the song forms and the theoretical structure of how these songs all work, and the history of jazz, and listening to everybody from Charlie Parker to somebody new or whatever, you know, fill in the blanks with all the people you'd listen to.
Uh-huh.
For the vocalists, it's Ella Fitzgerald and everybody in that genre. You collect all that information, and it's now your toolkit by which you just sort of musically do your thing. And so we're all very comfortable jumping into a band and saying, okay, what tune are we going to do? Let's do Autumn Leaves. Okay, what key? What tempo? Ready? Go. And you just jump in,
wow.
Sing, you're listening, you're responding to the other instrumentalists, and taking some solos, and interacting with each other, and that spontaneity can exist very easily with vocalists as well.
Very cool. Obviously, we're all impressed with your music and your performances. We're all impressed also with your commitment to music education. You stage clinics and workshops for young people. You have a well-known summer camp in Ohio.
Right.
Does that correlate to mentoring that you may have received early on? I mean, do you have memories of being supported and encouraged as a young person?
Definitely. We all, to varying degrees, came through relatively typical public schools in the United States, and we all have certain teachers, whether it was our band director or a choral director or a private teacher that we worked with, and then, of course, teachers in college as well that really helped develop our musical sense and also helped us develop our sense of discipline and working towards goals and striving for something good and all those kind of things. So, yeah, we've had various mentors over the years, both individually and collectively, that were a big part of what helped shape who we are today.
Did you know early on that music was going to be your career?
I did. I think you get a slightly different answer from the other members. It varies from person to person. But I was pretty sure. My parents were artists, visual artists. My dad taught college. And the idea of getting into the arts was certainly supported in my family. I never had my parents giving me the "what are you going to do for a real job" lecture.
good. Yeah.
So it just was kind of the way I was wired. I think pretty early on, kind of figured out that music just made me tick, and I would just sit there, and even as a kid, before I even really knew much about any style of music, and would sit at the piano and play chords and try to figure out what they were, and started singing in the choir and playing in band. You know, just kind of went down that path, and it would never really turned back.
Neat. From all that I know, in Eau Claire, you are diving into a hotbed of people, young learners and impressive mentors who love and are devoted to and doing wonderful things with jazz and music in general. These kinds of experiences, I would believe, must renew your faith in the future of your sport. And I call it a sport because it appears you guys are having a lot of fun.
Yeah, jazz as a contact sport. We really do love getting involved in schools and communities that really do support the arts. You know, we don't find that's universal, but it is alive and well. Oftentimes, this day and age, there's this question about in jazz and in music in general, whether it's pop, classical, jazz. You know, are the arts going to survive? Is it supported? You know, you hear about this symphony that's not able to last any longer, or this jazz club that closes, and this record label that shuts down, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, we're still all wired to enjoy music and need music in our life. And then when it's supported in the educational structure of the community, I think that really helps to continue it in a broader way. And so, yeah, we're looking forward to coming out to Eau Claire, where I've heard great things about the music community and this particular festival. So looking forward to it.
Great. It's going to be fun watching New York voices meet Wisconsin musicians. Darman Meter, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Looking forward to coming out this weekend.
Travel safe.
All right, Al. We'll talk to you soon.
The Eau Claire Jazz Festival, the 48th year. So much to do, so much to hear. Big show Friday night, 7 o'clock, State Theater. Those guys, New York Voices. After that, 52nd Street, downtown Eau Claire. That's fun. Saturday evening at 7, Memorial High School Auditorium, the trumpet of Terrell Stafford and the electricity of pianist Nachito Herrera. Still time to grab your tickets online at eauclairejazz.com/tickets. The Eau Claire Male Chorus presents their Spring Sing Friday evening at 7:30 in the Regis High School Auditorium. Advance tickets at area supermarkets. There's a dinner concert Saturday beginning at 5:30 in the Grand Ballroom of the Masonic Lodge in Eau Claire. Chorus members sing and are waiters as well. Reservations required. The phone number is 835-7369 or contact a chorus member. The website is eauclairemalechorus.org. This is Spectrum West. We appreciate you along for the ride. Here now is the second scoop of Oliver that I promised. Jim Oliver back with another slice of West Wisconsin theater.
University of Wisconsin Eau Claire Music and Theater Arts Department will present Anton Chekhov's The Three Sisters tonight, Thursday, through Saturday, and the following Wednesday through Sunday in the Kirov Theater at the University. The production is directed by Arthur Grothy. assistant professor of music and theater arts at the university, and Professor Grothery joins us to talk about The Three Sisters. The play was first performed at the Moscow Art Theater in 1901, but this is a recent translation by the playwright Sarah Rule. Tell us about the Rule translation that was, I think, first staged in 2009. Does that sound about right?
Yep. Yeah, she's a new playwright. She's been around for a couple of years now, but she's sort of been the toast of the theatrical world, but she's had a couple big successes. She has a very lyrical style, which I think lends itself to some of the original work that Chekhov was doing. Some of the earliest translations can come across today as very staid, hard for us to access, given our speech patterns today and love of technology, love of stuff. And so hers kind of flows nicely. I think it's good for the students to be able to access it while staying true to, I think, his original intents.
So the story is the same. It's just a different vernacular.
Yes. Whatever. The sisters don't get to Moscow. They they're still stuck.
Stuck in a small town.
Stuck in their small town. Stuck in their home.
Uh-huh. How large is the cast of the play?
It's 14 people with about three roles that are double cast to offer a couple other opportunities for some students to participate. Mm-hmm. There's no real Hamlet-type lead character. There's a big ensemble cast where everybody is contributing to the fabric of this world.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to the play. I've neglected to ask you what the play is about.
Well, like I said, this very, very short version is. You have three sisters that really want to get to Moscow, and they just don't get there. So the longer version is that you've got a family that has been an aristocracy that is falling as the merchant class is rising, and they are unable to adapt to the changing world. And so they really get stuck, rooted in their place.
Well, the synopsis that I read had it in four acts. Is that true?
Well, they're four shorter acts.
Okay.
And yeah, Chekhov was never known for his, sometimes not known for his brevity, but we have tried to do some things to help pick up on some of the humor that I think he intended. And Stanislavski took and directed differently, but he really always thought he wrote very situational comedies.
Talk about the technical aspects of the show, the set, all those mundane things that are terribly important to a production.
Well, in this one, they're probably not that mundane, because normally you would see Chekhov or one of the other founding realism playwrights done very traditionally in the period, with period costumes, period props, period set. And one of the big debates that we had between myself and the technical crew and the design team was, why are we going to do this play today? Why does it matter? Why tell the story? So we looked for a place that we could possibly move the play to that would still keep in line with the core concept, still keep in line with what he was driving at, but allow our actors, allow our audience, allow our designers to have some fun with it. So we actually moved it to 2005 Detroit. And then took a very abstract look at the set and did some things to kind of highlight the steel of Detroit, because you have a city that really struggled. You know, by 2008... they're debating about whether to sell their art museum collection to pay their bills and letting some houses burn because it's cheaper than raising them. And so we took that idea, because in all of his Chekhov's plays, you have these crumbling mansions, these crumbling houses that symbolize the decay of the aristocracy. And so we took those ideas, played with them, tweaked them some, built out past our proscenium to bring it as close to the audience as we could. And there's some kind of monolithic-looking set pieces that I think will surprise some people because they bend and twist some. But it's ideally, hopefully, all to get at this core struggle of these characters in their life and where they are.
He is Arthur Grothy, who is director of the UW Eau Claire Music and Theater Arts Department production of The Three Sisters. I got to get back to this Detroit stuff. Are they trying to get to Detroit, or are they still trying to get to Moscow?
It's a big debate, too. And after a lot of back and forth and a lot of looking at it and looking at some other versions, we have kind of done what you would do with a Shakespeare edit update or resetting it. So the language has not changed, because really for these three sisters, Detroit could be anywhere. Detroit could be La Crosse. It's just better in La Crosse than it is in Eau Claire. It just is the place on the horizon that looks shiny in the distance. It really seemed to us like, it could be Chicago for them. And as long as that sense of Moscow was imbued with these ideas and filled with that energy, it would continue to tell the story.
So they live in a small town outside of Detroit?
Yes.
Does a little town have a name, or did you pick a town?
Well, we put them kind of in those outskirts suburbs of Detroit.
Okay. Well, along with Henrik Ibsen and August Strindberg, Chekhov is often referred to as one of the three influential figures in the birth of early modernism in the theater. I can't ever let a theater professor get out of here without trying to explain to me what early modernism is in the theater. One of these days I'll get the idea, but they've tried mightily and failed. But
you know, I think what's hard for us to understand today is that when these three guys came along and they started writing realism, it was a shock to the proverbial system. Mm-hmm. And people would go and they would pick at the plays, scream at the plays. They were just so insulted that people would behave normally. So what we take for granted today was really earth-shattering 100 years ago. And so when they say early modernism, it's those, I think, the beginnings of looking at people as psychological beings versus just archetypes or caricatures. And so his characters have depth, have nuance, have contradiction, have pauses, and he's doesn't quite fall into that naturalism category where people would just mumble a lot and talk and then face away from the audience. And but they started to really look at the psychological motivations. And when that comes along, it just drives people nuts. Ibsen's Dollhouse had to have a second ending because people couldn't believe that a woman would ever leave her husband.
Wow. Amazing. Chekhov wrote only four full-length plays that I could find, The Seagull, Uncle Vanya, The Three Sisters, and The Cherry Orchard. So how did he come to such high prominence?
Well, he's got a fifth play that nobody ever does. I shouldn't say nobody. I think Yale Rep might have done it. But Ivanov is his fifth play, kind of the lost. Distant cousin that nobody talks about, I guess.
Okay. So there were five. All right. I said corrected, as somebody once said.
But, you know, I think why he, you know, the Moscow Art Theater and he really go hand in hand. Konstantin Stanislavski comes along and creates the system of acting and is really the first person to say, hey, you can learn to be a better actor. You can have your own interpretation. Before, if you wanted to be an actor, you would just be my apprentice and I would perform the role and you would mimic all that I did and try to be the best me that you could be. And that was really actor training. And so he comes along, has this whole idea of how to create a character, how to craft a character. And probably one of the most influential theater artists we have because everybody's either working in line with him or against him. And he uses Chekhov as a vehicle to relay, to utilize his system. And that's where the famous argument comes between the two of them. He directs his plays as tragedies, and they're wonderfully successful. And the Moscow Art Theater's symbol is still the seagull because that play saved their theater. And if it doesn't happen and is not a success, it closes. And they actually, there's a famous story of they finish this production and everything's on the line and all the actors are really worked up and they're trying this new thing and everybody's scared and the show ends and it's dead silence. And everybody's backstage going, I guess we're going back to the potato farm because there's nothing else for us to do. And then the lights come back and it's just thunderous applause and everybody is enthralled by this new work and that saves the theater.
Tell me a little bit about your background in theater.
Originally, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I lived there for a number of years, went to Heidelberg University for undergrad, which was a small private liberal arts college. Then went to the University of Florida, which is kind of the exact opposite of a small private liberal arts college for graduate school on the other end of the country. And then back to Cleveland and worked as a freelance actor, director, worked at a community college as associate technical director and also adjunct faculty for a couple of years. Then went down to teach at the University of West Alabama and was director of theater and chair of fine arts. And since I apparently can't decide if I like snow or if I miss snow or if I just miss seasons, I don't know. But I ended up moving up to Wisconsin, obviously, in the fall.
Oh, great. Well, the play is Anton Chekhov's The Three Sisters with translation by Sarah Rule. The University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire production, directed by Professor Arthur Grothy, will be staged tonight, Thursday, through Saturday, and the following Wednesday through Sunday at the Keir Theater at the University. For ticket information, contact the Service Center at the University in person or call 715-836-3727. Professor Grothy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And thanks, as always, to Mr. Oliver, as I said, a double dip today. Spectrum Memos, the National Players, conclude the artist series at UW-Eau Claire with a performance of To Kill a Mockingbird, 7:30 p.m. Tuesday at Schofield Auditorium. Tickets at the Service Center, by phone at 836-4636, and at the door. This year's Essentially Eau Claire artist is Larry Lelly, a 1990 UWEC grad and one of the top freelance drummers in New York City. That concert is next Thursday, the 23rd of April, 7 p.m. at Memorial High School in Eau Claire, and will also feature Memorial Jazz Ensembles. The Eau Claire School District opens its annual Spring Art Show with a 5:30 p.m. reception Friday in the John D. Beck Student Art Gallery at the Board of Ed building on Main Street. More than 800 works on display through mid-May. Shell Lake Art Center looking for new homes for two pianos, I think. Still, maybe they found them. Hopefully they'll let us know if they did. You can go to shelllakeartcenter.org to fill out an application. At the Northern Lake Center for the Arts in Amory, there's an art exhibit featuring work by Julie Adams and Jan Killian that is still up through April 28th. Their website is northernlakescenter.org. Lots, as always, going on in western Wisconsin in the arts, music, culture, humanities. Hey, I am grateful to Mackenzie Wagner, Debbie Brown, and Dean Kallenbach for propping us up each week with promotion and production support. Couldn't do it without them. And cheers to you, of course, for coming along for the ride each week. Next week, an art fair that celebrates spring. Students present music and art that go together nicely and more. I'm Al Ross. Hope to see you at the big Eau Claire Jazz Festival somewhere or along the sidewalk downtown Eau Claire sometime. Have a good week. See you next week.